Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we get the latest on flooding on the Kings River in Tulare County as people begin to mop up there. Also, there's a potential new owner poised to take over the Fresno Grizzlies. We'll find out what the new lease agreement with the team means for City Hall's general fund. And a funeral ceremony for unclaimed babies that helps adults volunteering get peace in their lives. All that coming up. And Avi Kaplan, singer with the Pentatonix. He's from Visalia, and he joins us later in our program. Right now, though, we turn to an issue in the world of healthcare. California has a bounty of natural resources, from agriculture to timber and much, much more. But the state is also sitting on an unstable foundation that threatens to shake everything to the ground. Earthquakes. One of those earthquakes more than two decades ago is still sending aftershocks through hospitals across the state, including here in the Valley. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess explains.
On January 17th in 1994, before the sun even rose, the peace of a Los Angeles morning was broken when the ground began to shake.
Mother Nature's big blow hit in the pre-dawn darkness. It measured 6.6 on the Richter scale and was centered near Northridge. As of now, the toll from...
That's news reporting from LA's ABC television station as the impacts of what would soon be called the Northridge earthquake became clear. When the dust settled, 57 people were dead and tens of billions of dollars in damage had occurred. Among the most important buildings crippled were 11 hospitals that were either damaged or rendered inoperable because of the quake. That spurred the legislature to act and require every acute care hospital, regardless of their seismic risk, to be able to withstand a major earthquake. Now, more than two decades after the passage of the law, many hospitals in Central California are still struggling to raise the money necessary to do expensive expansions or retrofits. Even some of the biggest hospitals in the area, Mercy Hospital in Bakersfield, and Community Regional and St. Agnes in Fresno, all have buildings that need improvements to withstand a major quake. However, unlike public hospitals, they do not need to seek the approval of voters to issue bond debt. In the last 14 months, three public hospitals, Cahuilla Delta, Tulare Regional, and Kern Valley, have all sought public support for a bond for earthquake improvements and been soundly rejected.
Each floor would have to be gutted, and again, they would be... literally driving iron pillars through the hospital.
You could almost visualize as you're pushing gurneys through the hallways, you're having to duck.
That's Gary Herbst, the chief financial officer of Cahuilla Delta Hospital in Visalia, talking about what it would take to retrofit the cramped 50-year-old acute care wing called Mineral King, which he says is impractical. However, building a new earthquake-compliant wing would cost more than $500 million. So the hospital went to the public and lost on a $327 million bond with just 42% support to fund the construction of an entirely new wing.
We have to find a way to replace those beds. This community is depending on us to continue to be here, to take care of them, to provide the health care that they've come to expect.
After voters rejected the proposal so thoroughly last May, Herp said they've had to return to the drawing board with no clear path forward. And here's the dilemma. The clock is ticking for the hospitals. The state says if they aren't up to code by 2030, they will be shut down. That's a big reason why so many hospitals are going to voters now to get this expensive and complicated work underway. Waiting, say hospital CEOs, pushes them ever closer to being shut down by the state for non-compliance. Earlier this month, Kern Valley Hospital lost a $32 million bond vote on its third attempt to secure community funding for new construction and retrofitting of existing structures. CEO Tim McGlew says it doesn't matter what the reason is. The bottom line is the work has to be done, or it's curtains for his hospital, which provides critical care in the Lake Isabel area.
My biggest frustration has been the fact that the government never provided any funds to make this happen. There was no new reimbursement streams that were created to allow hospitals to begin saving for this. There was no monies that were set aside to make this happen. It was an unfunded mandate.
Compounding the problem is the fact that these hospitals have to win their vote with nearly 67% approval. That's a monster climb for any issue, let alone one where they're asking people to willingly agree to tax themselves.
School districts only have to get 55% of the vote in order to get a bond passed or a tax measure passed. Hospitals and everyone else has to get 67%. So this has been a pretty tall order.
McGlue says factoring in high poverty rates in the area, coupled with a strong anti-tax bent, and he sees little chance of a bond passing, especially since residents seem to believe the state will simply extend the deadline as they've done in the past. Don't count on that, says the Office of Statewide Planning and Development, or OSHPD, which oversees hospital compliance. In an email, a spokesman says there's no mechanism to extend the deadline and no provision for the state to come in and take over. It's fix or build a new hospital or else. But Tulare Regional Medical Center CEO Benny Benzivi says the community doesn't seem all that inclined to see it that way.
I think there's also a great anti-establishment sentiment, a wave going through the country right now, and I think that's affecting these bonds as well. It's unfortunate because people don't wait to get sick, so we can't wait till the wave passes to build a hospital. We need to build a hospital now.
Tulare Regional is the third hospital in the valley to have an earthquake-proofing bond fail. Last August, they sought $55 million to complete a long-stalled hospital tower. Benzivi says if they can't get a bond through, their only option will be to seek a hard-to-acquire loan, which he says would be a waste compared to a bond.
It's inevitable that at some point the community will have to carry some of the cost. That's why it's a community hospital. The loan will be great, but that creates an undue burden of the hospital. And so instead of using the money we'd use for loan payments towards more and better services, we'll have to redirect that money towards loan repayment.
All three hospitals say they have or are considering turning to the legislature for special exemptions or to lower the vote threshold. But all three also admit that's an unlikely outcome. But in the meantime, they're watching as the months and years tick by and sounding increasingly urgent alarms to a public that appears to have little interest in listening. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. Pine Flat Reservoir on the Kings River east of Fresno is currently holding back nearly 1 million acre-feet of water. That's more water than's been there since any time since 2011. Over the weekend, releases from the dam reached 15,000 cubic feet a second. That led to flooding in low-lying areas downstream and also stressed levees in the area, especially in our area around Kingsburg at the Kings River Golf and Country Club in Tulare County. Joining us now to tell us a little more about what the situation is like right now is Carrie Montero with the Tulare County Sheriff's Office. Carrie, welcome.
Hello, good morning.
So since this weekend, operators of the dam have reduced water releases as the snowmelt coming in has slowed down as temperatures have dropped. What's the situation like right now? There are 90 homes in the area that this weekend your office said were in danger of flooding. What's happening there right now?
So right now, we still have mandatory evacuation orders in place. However, we are seeing signs of the water receding. We have reports from the Army Corps of Engineers at Pine Flat Dam that they've lowered releases. The last report was yesterday to 13,200 CFS, and they're doing it in increments to have prepared it down to 12,200 CFS, which is very favorable. Right now, we currently have crews and teams out in the field doing damage assessments, assessing building infrastructure for those homes that were affected between a foot to 12 feet of water into them, as well as we have our environmental health and public health damage assessments with our Office of Emergency Services on the scene, and we want to make sure that the area and specifically those homes that did have severe flooding are safe to return to before we change those mandatory evacuation orders. So those teams are on the scene. They started yesterday afternoon. They're meeting this morning to get together on their assessments to make sure that the water is safe, their homes are safe, and safe for people to return to.
It's been 5 years of drought. I imagine it's quite a strange situation now, being in a position to respond to major flooding. Is this something that the county trains for, even in dry years?
Absolutely. We're always training, and we're well aware, and our leaders are well aware that usually following a drought, you get a flood. So we were prepared. Our Office of Emergency Services, our fire, our sheriff, all participating county departments, as well as regional agencies and organizations. We had the state Cal OES on scene assisting us in this incident. And so we mobilized when we've been monitoring it. Our fire crews have been monitoring the situation back since June 18th when we had flood concerns in the Riverland area. And then we saw it definitely increase with the increased flows. And we mobilized pretty quickly and effectively.
So was this simply a matter of a levee failing? Has that been repaired, or is this overtopping the existing levees that are out there?
No, that's a good question. We had three breaches. Two of those breaches, we call them 1A and 1B, were along the Kings River golf course. And they were brims or dirt piles, kind of minor levees that were man-made to help protect the golf course. And we had some breaches in those that we had crews working overnight to hand crews piling sandbag walls. And then one breach, the river does kind of a really sharp turn, and it actually wasn't a levee, is that the water was coming so fast, it frankly blew out the riverbank and started flooding into farmland. And so that was a major breach. I've heard estimates of about 50 feet where the riverbank gave out. And that's the breach that we have our main focus on, with helicopter aerial operations dropping super sandbags filled with rocks. And that started on Sunday and ran yesterday. And we're hoping to have that breach resolved and controlled flows in that area later today.
Now, there's other developments along the river, maybe not quite as intense as the golf course. Are other areas still threatened? I know Riverland was dealing with this flooding far before others, and that's right at Highway 99 in the Kings River. Are there other areas you're still concerned about in your county?
Yes, there are other areas. We have teams going out to Lindy's Landing is another area of focus, as well as the Royal Oaks Area Club is another area that's been effective. A lot of those areas aren't necessarily permanent homes. They have more of mobile homes, but we do have teams, assessment teams in those areas offering services to residents there. So we're looking at this as not only do we have the area of the Kings River golf course, but we have Lindy's Landing and the Royal Oaks area, as well as further downstream, the area of Riverland Resort.
Is there any idea on when the people in the evacuation around the golf course might begin to return home?
We're hoping soon. We had positive reports from our preliminary damage assessments yesterday afternoon. They're meeting again, and I anticipate if those reports come back positive. And what I mean reports is we're looking at where the water systems compromised and are they contaminated with river water? Was septic and sewer systems compromised, and do we have water contamination there? And those are what they are looking at. Are the building structures inhabitable and weren't compromised? And if those reports continue to come back positive this morning, we hope to be able to give the green light and allow it to be safe for residents to return home, hopefully later today, maybe tomorrow at the latest.
All right. Well, thank you for the update on that situation, which we'll continue to follow on all Valley Rivers. Again, Kerry Montero with the Tulare County Sheriff's Office talking about flooding at the Kings River Golf and Country Club just east of Kingsburg in Tulare County. Kerry, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last month, you may have heard about Miranda Eve, a mysterious baby who was uncovered in San Francisco and identified more than a century after she died. The organization that kickstarted that investigation was the Garden of Innocence, a nonprofit that provides burial services to unclaimed children across the state. Over the weekend, the Fresno chapter held a service for babies abandoned in Fresno County. But as FM 89's Carrie Klein reports, the garden serves more than just children.
Ryan Murray was 31 when his wife gave birth to a stillborn baby girl. Adriana would have been their first child.
You think, oh, this is going to be the only opportunity to be a father. I mean, that's the kind of statement that went on in my mind, like, this was it. What comes after this? No one prepared me.
Murray retreated into himself, lost interest in his job, and disappeared from his marriage.
A lot of inward self-destructive behavior at the time. I was drinking alcohol. That was my pacifier.
That was 6 years ago. Now, Murray says he's sober. His marriage is stronger than ever, and he's found fulfillment in a new career. The turnaround, he says, was sparked by one thing, the Garden of Innocence. Murray, a videographer and photographer, volunteered to document its first Fresno service in 2012.
And to give a piece of yourself and not ask of anything in return was something that changed my life forever. It changed the trajectory, changed the path of where I was going.
He's been volunteering ever since, along with a team of florists, carpenters, pastors, and performers who all donate their time and services twice a year. They're not the only ones touched by this organization. Even on this blazing hot Saturday, close to 100 people have carved time out of their weekend to attend. Although these ceremonies are ostensibly for abandoned babies, they can help heal the living as well.
When I get to walk away from here knowing that I have done something for my community, that's great. It's great. That just makes me feel good.
Roy Bell is director of the Fresno Garden of Innocence, a roughly 300-square-foot plot of land in the middle of Mountain View Cemetery. Since the garden opened in 2012, he's overseen the burial of 92 babies and toddlers. The children come from the county coroner. They don't have names. How they get there, Bell doesn't know. A baby found in a San Diego trash can is what gave rise to the organization in the first place.
We aren't allowed to know, and I really don't want to know. That baby didn't have an opportunity to have a dignified burial, and my heart just says, why not?
Bell says the goal of the garden is to lavish these babies with the attention and love they didn't get while alive. Community members give each baby a name and place its ashes in a handmade urn. Today, they honor 11 babies. The ceremony lasts over an hour and begins with bagpipers and an escort from the county sheriff's honor guard.
I'd like to welcome Patrick to the garden.
Each baby is introduced by name, and members of local Elks lodges deliver the urns in tuxedos and white gloves before volunteers recite handwritten poems.
Don't cry for me because I've died. I'm not far away. I'm still by your side. I'm the angel that sits here with you.
The baby's comfort is taken care of, too. They're placed in vaults in pairs, so they're not alone, with beanie babies and handmade blankets. Bell says right before they're buried, the urns are passed around to everyone in attendance.
We don't know if these babies were ever held, were ever kissed, were ever loved, but we wanted to give them that opportunity.
Many here are driven by religion or simply a love of children, but there's another contingent here, too. Those recovering from loss, like Myrna Wasson.
I guess one of the things that stirs me is because I had 2 miscarriages. This is a chance just to show love to the babies.
Raylene Ramirez lost her teenage daughter to cancer and now volunteers regularly.
It's a warmth that you can't put into words. It gives you such a sense of fulfillment and a sense of belonging.
This funeral is really a celebration, a happy ending to tragedy. And it's that way for Ryan Murray, too. After our interview, he shows me into a quiet room in his house.
This is Gabriel Owen Murray. He's 10 months old. This is him. He's a miracle boy.
It turns out Adriana wasn't his last opportunity to be a father. He'll always honor her. He and his wife dedicated a memorial to her in their house. But now they have Gabriel and his 3-year-old brother Andrew to celebrate, too. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
With summer officially in full swing, peaches and other stone fruit are near their ripest. A lot of the tastiest fruit and veggies grown here in Central California aren't cosmetically appealing, though, so they don't actually make it into stores. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, one organic family farm near Fresno, growing tiny, tasty peaches, is trying to change American beauty standards around fruit.
Before Nikiko Masumoto picks a peach, she lightly squeezes it.
We want it to have some give and not be hard like a baseball, but we want it to be firm enough that it will travel to wherever it needs to go.
The peaches she's picking now are large, sweet, and will be sold mostly in the Bay Area. But a few weeks ago, they were picking another variety, a tiny peach called Gold Dust.
We're standing right now in the Flavorcrest Orchard, and as you can see, these fruit have much more red in them. The Gold Dust, when it's ripe, it's a very glowing amber, yellow, gold color.
The family planted 3 acres of the variety 10 years ago on their 80-acre farm in Delray. They knew the fruit was going to be smaller than normal, but they planted the crop anyway because the flavor is so rich and sweet. They even helped create a program with Bay Area companies and grocers to promote the fruit and were hoping that would be enough. It worked when sold directly, but a different story played out at the grocery level.
They had trouble selling the Gold Dust. And it was so painful to hear that after all of this effort, great coverage in the Bay Area by the San Francisco Chronicle, and still there weren't enough people who would take a chance on this small peach.
So let's take a step back. Why is Nikiko Masumoto unsettled? The family decided to try something unconventional. They told the story of this tiny peach by launching a campaign online and by working directly with a handful of Bay Area tech companies, food collaboratives, and restaurants.
I thought maybe the people angle, the ability to connect directly with people who care about the story behind food, maybe that's the angle to explore.
The Bay Area group Real Food, Real Stories partnered with the Masumotos to make this happen. The group's mission is to humanize the food movement by connecting people and farmers. Peru Koa is with the group.
We've been picking food based on shelf stability, size, durability, and yield. And all of those things have become more important than flavor.
They created the hashtag #EatSmallFruit and found buyers like Google and Airbnb. Small fruit ambassadors traveled to the farm, picked the fruit themselves, and then brought it to the buyers.
The first bite I had of the peaches and with the juice dripping down my arms, I felt very confused. Like, this delicious of a peach is what we want to throw away or what our market is deemed not valuable.
Co says Google served the fruit whole, and at Airbnb, employees biked around the office handing out the peaches. A collaborative in the Bay Area called Kitchen Town that helps people form food startups held a preserve class with the peaches as the main ingredient. Daniel Nevers is with the group.
I spoke with one of the bakeries about doing special peach pastries, amazing peach pastries coming out of the oven. Then we're also doing a peach workshop for the public to come in and meet with one of our makers who does Indian chutneys.
Nikiko Masumoto says she's still unsure if the pilot project was a total success because she thinks they may have just broken even financially. She says they'll probably do the pilot program again with a few tweaks, but because Americans have been trained to like big peaches, she says they really have to consider whether it's worth it.
If someone has never had an amazing peach and they go to the grocery store, of course they're going to look for the visually stunning peach because they don't know any better.
Masumoto says the time it takes to organize this program might outweigh how much it costs to run it and grow the peaches. Dana Fraz is the founder of Food Shift. The group works to reduce food waste, and she says campaigns like the Masumoto's are part of a larger effort to change views around what good food looks like.
This is about fundamentally shifting the way we value food. These efforts are so much bigger than what they might seem like on the surface.
She says other companies have done well by giving tiny fruit value. Think mandarins like cuties and halos. But for a small farm with 3 acres of fruit, the uphill battle is steep. Fraz says even for incremental change, it's going to take a large-scale effort from all parts of the food industry.
It's really hard because habits are hard to break. And again, you have a society that kind of reinforces convenience and waste and perfection. People are getting smarter about working together on this. everyone's doing their part.
One Bay Area company has managed to utilize small and ugly fruits and veggies grown in the valley. Imperfect Produce takes funny-looking or discolored products and sells them in a weekly box delivered straight to your door. They have about 15,000 customers statewide. Ron Clark with the company says the Masumoto's pilot project could be successful if they continue to intentionally sell these tiny peaches.
We find once people taste it, they're really sold. Our hope is that it won't just benefit us. What we want to see is that this changes consumers' tastes far beyond whatever Imperfect offers.
He says if the pilot program doesn't work, the Masumoto's could possibly market their tiny peaches to kids or even sell them to his company, where his buyers already value ugly and tiny fruit. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And this is Valley Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and find out what the new lease agreement between the city of Fresno and the Fresno Grizzlies means for the city's bottom line, and about potential new owners poised to take over the team. Also, singer Avi Kaplan from the Pentatonix. He's from Visalia, and he joins us in our next segment. He's got a new side project. We'll hear about that and more. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Yesterday, the Fresno City Council unanimously approved a new lease agreement with the Fresno Grizzlies for the downtown baseball stadium known as Chuck Chancey Park. For the better part of 25 years, the fate of AAA baseball and the city's bottom line have been linked, as a long quest to build the stadium was followed by an even longer quest to try to find a way to pay for it. That's an ongoing problem, and George Hostetter of the Central Valley Observer is here to tell us more. George, welcome.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I guess we should predicate this discussion by saying for at least the last 4 years, the current owners of the team have been trying to sell it, and for even longer than that, they've been having some financial hardships, losing a good bit of money. A big part of their expenses happens to deal with the rent for the stadium. What does this new agreement do that the old agreement didn't?
Well, first of all, let me say, you know, you're right. At the council meeting yesterday, they were talking about how for 4 years, the Fresno Baseball Club has been trying to sell it. I'm not so sure that's true. It might have been for 4 years City Hall has wanted the Fresno Baseball Club out of Fresno. But I'm not 100% convinced everyone within the Fresno Baseball Club wants to sell. But there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes pressure and arm-twisting, et cetera. But
well, everything's for sale for a price. This happens to be what that price is.
Sure, you gave it a big enough price, somebody will sell. But the marriage between City Hall and Fresno Baseball Club certainly was strained for a while. So and now we have this new lease. To me, Joe, what has occurred was set in place in October of 2000. The June 26, 2017 was inevitable once the council approved the deal that they did with John Carbery and the Fresno Diamond Group some 17 years ago.
But that was a very different deal for $1.5 million in lease. Annually with the team, and now we're down to what, 500,000?
500,000, but precisely, that was the whole point that, as you recall back then, the $1.5 million rent, even then, practical people knew it wasn't going to fly. Everyone talked about, well, for public consumption, yep, $1.5 million really reduced the hit to the general fund because of the debt service on the construction bonds, but the clock was ticking immediately to that it would have to, the lease payments, the lease rent would have to be reformed. And slowly but surely over those next 17 years, and especially after the Grizzlies moved in on May 1st, 2002, slowly but surely we had crises. And the rent got whittled down. So June 26, 2017 comes, and now it's from $1.5 million through these steps down to $500,000 a year. Well, Joe, what do you think the chances are that on June 26th, 2019, we might be back there again saying, you know, $500K, that might be a little bit high, you know, and we're losing X amount and you want us to survive, want a viable owner in there, blah, blah, blah. We go through this again. And I would I won't bet a Kit Kat, but I suspect we'll be revisiting this rent in the coming years. You and I will be.
Well, certainly the downtown stadium has been a controversial subject for years. Gary Bredefeld, who's now back on the city council, was one of the key leaders in the push for the stadium and to approve the original lease. He voted for this amended one, though. Was that a bit of a surprise, or is it just a political necessity? Because he, during the campaign last fall, was very adamant about criticizing any efforts to criticize the original deal, saying it was the best deal, and the team just didn't follow through on all those concert promotions that were supposed to bring in that extra money.
Right, and if you listen to Gary's comments from the dais yesterday, he went down that path also, saying, you know, it was a great deal. We had to act in 2000. Oftentimes you don't get to act under perfect circumstances and create the perfect deal, but we acted, we got a stadium, and now we can reform it. But yes, if you recall also Gary during that campaign, but it was a mayoral campaign too, and Henry R. Perea had a similar point of view in his debates with Lee Brand, because Henry was on that 2000 council that voted for this stadium deal. And as I recall, Henry in his campaign said, similar to Gary, listen, put me in the office and we're going to make them pay $1.5 million. And the deal will work, and the general fund will be benefited by it. Well, Gary's campaign statements worked for him. It didn't work for Henry R.
Well, very interesting. We'll never know what a Perea mayoral election would have meant for the team. But we do know that there is a new ownership group in the wings. Presumably this new lease agreement was necessary, at least from the club's perspective, to bring in new owners. What do we know about these potential new owners? Because the sale hasn't gone through yet.
Right. There's a limited liability company that will own the, according to the staff report, a limited liability company will own the Grizzlies, and then they're above this limited liability company. There are two more LLCs above it. So, in other words, the there's a overall organization, and then a subsidiary owns the Grizzlies. Now, what we know, and it was like pulling teeth to get this from anybody at City Hall to confirm the names, and even then it was done on the sort of QT. But there is Jim Kufos is one of the principals. Now, what I know of Jim Kufos is that I think he used to be a partner in Goldman Sachs, and from Southern California, and that he was a part owner, half owner, or substantial owner of what used to be the High Desert Mavericks.
In the Single A California League.
Right, and the High Desert Mavericks no longer exist, right? I think at the end of the 2016 season, the Bakersfield Cal League team and the High Desert died from lack of attendance. And if you do some research on the internet, you'll find out that the High Desert Mavericks and the City Hall, where the home field was, Adelanto, am I pronouncing that correctly? It's near Lancaster, Palmdale, in the desert in Southern California. There was quite a brouhaha over that. The parting wasn't entirely pretty, and so there's that. And then, of course, two more principals are Ray Baker and Michael Baker, father son out of Denver. And Ray Baker is involved in, at least from what I know, to a degree in baseball world through being the chairman of the board of the government entity that runs Coors Field, where the Rockies play their home games in Denver.
So we know this. Do we know, have any idea of a transaction price for this team? Because we know the Grizzlies haven't been making money, or at least a look at their financial statements would suggest as such. But is there a possibility the owners are making a decent profit on this sale, or what do we know?
Well, excellent question. No, I don't know. what the transaction price will be. A friend of mine, David Taub, the journalist who works for GV Wire, he has reported that the Grizzlies at one time had a market valuation. Of course, you know, whether somebody pays the cash for a market valuation, it's a different deal, but in the $23 million range. But, you know, what's interesting, Joe, is that you do hear on background at City Hall when you talk to sources that when it's sold, if it's sold and when it's sold, that the Fresno Baseball Club and its investors won't be making a profit. Now, that may just be information given to a reporter to somehow make this go down better with the taxpayers, but that when you consider all the money that they've put into it because they didn't make a profit year in, year out, in fact, they would lose $1.2 to $1.5 million a year, that they're going to end up, you know, like a homeowner underwater.
So speaking of a homeowner and being underwater, the City Hall also is something of a homeowner with Chuck Chancey Park. Opened in 2002, as you said. I remember that opening day. Optimism was very high. It was thought that this would spark a downtown rebirth. State-of-the-art stadium, that night it was absolutely jam-packed. It's not packed most evenings. In fact, it's far from packed most evenings. Right. And the stadium is now aging and needs some upgrades. How much did that play into this this overall issue?
Well, you know, excellent point. I don't know quite how to answer it except to say that it was brought up at yesterday's council meeting to City Manager Rudd. He was at the public microphone answering questions, you know, and he, this kind of big picture question was asked of Bruce. And Bruce goes, well, as a profit center, you know, the stadium obviously has failed, but as an amenity to help downtown, it has succeeded. And I was sitting in the audience thinking, well, I don't know if amenity is the right word. Joe, it's interesting about this stadium. You're right. When October of 2000 comes and the council agrees to build it, 5-2 vote. Of course, Jim Patterson later vetoes it. It gets overridden. So very contentious. And then remember, Alan Autry takes over as mayor soon after that. And this whirlwind effort to build it. May 1st, 2002 comes, high expectations. Well, Joe, how has downtown changed in those 15 years? And I would contend that the stadium has been a factor, and Bruce Rudd said this from the microphone yesterday, has been a key factor in those dramatic changes. I walked after the vote yesterday, as I like to walk, as you know, and so I walked throughout downtown, and it's really an amazing place, and it's changed just so dramatically. And I think the stadium has had a key part in that and deserves credit for it. So in that sense, even though the $1.5 million rent, blah, 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 that hasn't worked out, as you might say, I'm not so sure that somebody can say the taxpayer didn't get his or her money, a legitimate return on his or her money based on what's happened in downtown since then.
So I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but as I recall, it's around $3 million a year the city pays on debt service on the stadium. Is that sound about right to you?
Well, at first it was about $3.4 million and change. As City Manager Rudd pointed out yesterday, if you recall, maybe 3-4 months ago, City Hall refinanced the whole slew of bonds. And it turns out that the stadium bonds were part of that refinancing effort. So now the debt service is about 3.1. To somebody who's followed as much as I have, I found that very interesting that they've knocked $300,000 off of that, off the pay. And just to circle back, how everything's connected, Joe, is that, well, as you've noted earlier, that there's this maintenance issue at the stadium, and there's going to be this ongoing fund, $300,000 from the city and $300,000 from the new owners every year to help with maintenance. Well, by that reduction in the bonds, what they're paying, there's the $300,000 from City Hall without a hit to the general fund.
Very interesting. So with the other things that are going on downtown, do you see the stadium as being maybe even a potential for more development? We see that the Terrence Fraser and his group are building or plan to build a new retail complex on the parking lot in the corner of what was once the Fulton Mall and Inyo Street. If you look at the map, when they first talked about the schematics of that, they included in some of the later phases land that's actually part of the stadium itself, the player parking lot and things there. Do you think that's something that City Hall in the future might be looking at doing, is turning an asset into an underperforming asset into one that might generate some additional income by building on the site?
No, excellent point. I didn't realize that. Thanks for telling me that Terrence and would then end up building, I guess, a little bit to the west then, huh?
Well, it would be on Inyo Street. It would be further down. Mm-hmm. And in a later phase, is that something you think the city would be open at? Because we've even talked about, was there a potential for reducing the size of the stadium or doing other things like that? Because it is overbuilt for, frankly, what is generally brought in for regular attendance.
Oh, excellent point. But to answer your question, look at the Convention Center parking lot. The Cosmopolitan is on it. Clearly, City Hall and the private sector get together and do interesting things. The Cosmopolitan, from what I can gather, walking by it a lot, is very busy, as opposed to being in Chinatown where it was. So I can, I guess if the deal points are right, it would work. In a similar vein there, you and I have been talking during the break about this lease that also includes a provision where the new owners will host 100 events per year. And the definition of events doesn't necessarily some big concert from a big rock group or whatever it is, although that certainly is possible. But the idea is it might be a meeting, it might be a youth a soccer game, it might be a youth baseball game, whatever it might be, the whole range of community events, and hold 100 of them at some place in the stadium. It doesn't have to be on the field. You know, it could be in the concourse, it could be in the club, whatever it might be. And this is in the contract. From near as I can tell, it hadn't been in the contract, any of the other contracts, or amended contracts. So why? Well, I think as you were talking about geography, just if you look just due north of the stadium, Tulare and H, what do you have there? And I sense that the stadium will be a key factor in the development of this kind of geographic area that has nothing there. The Greyhound bus station used to be there. Obviously, the high-speed rail depot is going to go there. You've got parking lots heading, essentially nothing but parking lots heading due north to the Hotel Fresno. And I'm just wondering if City Hall is maneuvering in an indirect way to turning this area into Fresno's new Civic Square.
Very interesting thought. We'll have to see how it plays out, see if this new ownership deal plays out and actually closes, and what it means for the future of the team and City Hall's bottom line. I'm sure you'll be reading about it in the Central Valley Observer and hearing about it on Valley Public Radio. George Hostetter with the Central Valley Observer joining us today. George, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe, for having me.
Never really thought I'd get to see this day.
The voice you're listening to may sound familiar. That's because it's the voice of Avi Kaplan of the a cappella group Pentatonix. Kaplan, a bass in the group, is from Visalia and recently launched his own project called Avriel and the Sequoias. FM 89's Ezra David Romero had a chance to chat with him about why he's leaving Pentatonix and about his latest EP, Sage and the Stone.
Hey, Avi, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, no problem. How are you?
Pretty good. It's a beautiful day here in Central California, you know, 105.
Nice, yeah, absolutely. I know how that goes.
Yeah, you know how it is here. I think most people know about your connections and success with the a cappella group Pentatonix, but how did you get involved with this group?
I was asked to join the group when I was in college by Scott, and, you know, it was just kind of off of a whim, and you know, I joined the group. We auditioned for the show, the sing-off, and then we won that show. And then, you know, just kept going and going and going and did a lot of great things. And it was kind of a quick thing. And, you know, I didn't really expect it to go how it went, but it definitely did. It was a crazy ride.
Yeah. What was that experience like?
Oh, man. I mean, it's just been surreal. It's been crazy. I mean, doing something that I love that, you know, that is really, you know, seen as a risk to really the rest of the world, you know, being a musician, to have it be successful and for people to love it and for people to love what you do and to appreciate what you put out there. It's a really unbelievable feeling.
I think our listeners will be interested that you have your roots here in the Central Valley. Tell me about that. Did you go to school here?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Visalia, California. I went to Mountain View Elementary School. I went to Divisadero Middle School, and I went to Mount Whitney High School. I loved growing up in Visalia. It was a really amazing place to grow up. Music was a huge part of the community. Every school that I went to, music was very, very prevalent and very much encouraged. And so I feel super blessed to have been a part of a community that, you know, was so encouraging and supportive of music. And, you know, it's a beautiful place to grow up. I mean, there's just miles and miles of beautiful farmland, and the Sequoia National Park is not far at all. I used to be up there all the time, just exploring. I mean, I honestly couldn't have loved growing up there more. I love that I'm from there, which is why, you know, I named my new solo project, you know, after the Sequoias, because it's so, I love so much where I grew up. It means so much to me. It's so much part of who I am. And yeah, I just love it.
So Sequoia National Park is one of my favorite spots on Earth. I have memories of like jumping off cliffs at near Potwisha, the big trees, the beauty of the Great Western Divide. How has this region shaped your new project, Avriel and the Sequoias?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, if someone was to take a road trip from over the Grapevine all the way up to the Sequoias and they were to listen to my EP, I think that they would understand where all the music came from. I think it really fits the scenery of where I grew up. I feel like it really sets the scene for it. It's just something that I just feel like nature inspires that type of raw, acoustic, just super real type of folk music. It just feels right at home there. It feels like the soundtrack, you know?
Yeah, and you know, Visalia has that folk scene happening. And I mean, even in Bakersfield from like ages ago, it's
yeah.
Sort of traveled up, and that's sort of the history there. It kind of feels like you're, in a positive way, riding on the coattails of that and creating something new.
When I was growing up, the folk music was always something that I fell in love with. I mean, my mom was a huge fan of the Sons of the San Joaquin, and, you know, I love listening to them. It's amazing. I love that, you know, it all coincides with my hometown where I came from.
Let's talk about the songs. Is there a song in this EP that is dearest to your heart?
Each one of them, for one reason or another, means a great, great deal to me. I couldn't pinpoint one that would be the dearest to my heart. If you chose one song off the EP, I could absolutely tell you where it lies in my heart, you know. But they're all about equal, I would say.
So Sweet Adeline, you know, it seems to be the signature song. Talk to me about that one.
It's a love song. It's a type of love song where it embodies that love that is just, it's something that you can't deny, and it just makes you unbelievably happy. You know, it's just something where it's the type of love where you don't care what happens with it. You just want to be engulfed in it because it's so amazing and it makes you so happy. And that's kind of what I wanted to capture. It's that new love. It's that just that unbelievable feeling of butterflies, you know, just where you're just, you know, walking around whistling because you're so happy and you're so in love. That's what that song is about.
Let's take a listen.
Sweet Adeline, apple of my eye. Be mine. Where are you from? What do you do? Why did you run? Somebody's missing on you. If you're crying, sweet.
Your new EP is so different than what you created with Pentatonix. It's not Lady Gaga, Beyoncé covers, or your original songs. What are you most looking forward to in this next season of your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, this is the type of music that I have always grown up with. It's the type of music that I've written all my life. So it's really amazing to be able to get back to my roots and to be able to sing my own words and be able to express and emote things that are very, very dear to me. Lyrics are extensions of the soul. And it's just so exciting to be able to do that, to show people what I have to offer. I honestly couldn't be more excited for it, really. It's really a dream come true that I'm still able to do music and be able to do, you know, this type of music that's so dear to my heart.
Before we go, let's talk about Fields and Pier. What's that song all about?
So that song is a conversation between my past and present self, just kind of speaking to one another and, you know, just assuring that in my life, I've been on a lot of journeys, you know, I mean, coming from Visalia, going to LA, you know, just trying to be a musician in the world is just not exactly easy, you know. And so, you know, it's a journey song, and it's a conversation between my past and present self. It's kind of an encouragement to myself to keep going and keep fighting for my dreams, you know.
Yeah, let's listen to that song.
I will stay upon your mind when I'm gone. Fine, I will be gone for long.
Talking about that divide, thinking about like 10 years ago when you weren't in Pentatonix and you hadn't been found yet, did you ever think you were going to make it this big?
Definitely not. I definitely didn't think that my life would end up the way that it did. You know, if I were to go back 10 years and talk to my 18-year-old self about what is about to happen in the next 10 years, I wouldn't believe it. Not any part of it. It was always a dream of mine. But, you know, those are always dreams, or those are always something you're fighting for. But for them to actually come true and for you to be able to create your own destiny is a really surreal thing. It's really amazing.
Totally. And then there are the Grammys, right? I mean, that's like even more validation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I like everything that we've done has been an absolute dream come true. It's beyond anything that I ever could have imagined for myself. And it's just such an honor to have been a part of it and to be continuing on this journey and, you know, to strive for my next dreams and fight for what I believe in and give my music to the world, give my heart to the world, you know.
Finally, where can people find your work? And are you going to perform any of this stuff off your EP soon?
I don't think I'll be touring it quite soon. I would like to be playing live, but I think I'd like to get a little more content and put together a beautiful tour for people. And as for finding it, I mean, you can find it on iTunes, you can find it on Google Play, you can find it on Amazon, any place that you would hope to find it, you can find it there.
I've been chatting with Avi Kaplan about his new solo folk project, Avriel and the Sequoias. He's a Visalian native who made it big in the a cappella group Pentatonix. Thanks for joining me, Avi.
Yeah, no problem.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we want to know what you think. Email us your thoughts and comments. talk@kvpr.org is our email address. And you can find us on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. Find our podcast, our Valley Edition podcast, our Valley Public Radio News podcast, and our outdoorsy podcast on our website as well, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.